Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty's got the day off today. Safe to say, many of us don't give insects a second thought unless we're swatting at them, spraying them, or perhaps admiring a butterfly on a summer's day. But as scientists will remind us, insects are crucial to the world's ecosystems and to human well-being. And a recent article in the New York Times reports some startling and disturbing news. Across the globe, whole insect populations are crashing. The number of monarch butterflies, for instance, has fallen an estimated 90% in the last 20 years. Experts are warning that precipitous declines in the insect world lead to a devastating ripple effect impacting bird and animal populations and humans. For instance, it's estimated that losing pollinators costs agriculture billions a year. What's causing this and what are the remedies? And as you listen this hour, we're curious about your observations and thoughts. Here's the number, 888-477-9499. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Our guest for the first part of the hour is David Wagner, an insect conservationist and professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Connecticut. Welcome, David.
How are you doing?
Great, thanks. So, until we get into this news perhaps a little bit here, to begin, remind us of the work insects do and how their existence is tied to the world's ecosystem.
Well, we all need food, especially fruits and nuts are pollinated almost exclusively by bees. And so those are tremendously important. But even the world around us, what it looks like, 80% of all wildflowers that we love are pollinated by insects, moths, and bees, and a certain number of flies. So I can't imagine what the world would be like if we were to be without insects. But there's all kinds of ecosystem processes or ecosystem services that insects provide that we absolutely depend on. They remove dung, they remove carrion. They're part of macro decomposition. They take the leaves in the fall and turn them into topsoil. And another thing that they're probably quintessentially important in terms of doing for us is that they're actually the hamburger in our forest. They're the primary tethering or webbing of our food webs. And so we need these caterpillars and insects in our forest, in our woodlands, if we want to have baby birds, if we want to usher in spring with birdsong and have wildlife and nature in our yards, we're absolutely going to have insects. And so this decline that we're starting to see is very alarming.
Well, yeah, and as a matter of fact, David, bird populations are declining in Europe. Researchers have initially thought that maybe loss of habitat was the culprit, but now they're thinking that the loss of partridge and turtle dove populations and nightingale might be because these bird populations are starving.
Yeah, that's a really important part of solving this mystery or figuring out what's going on, but it looks like insect-eating birds and mammals are declining faster than other kinds of birds, say those that feed on seeds or grains. So there really is a signal here that something alarming is happening.
A study a few years ago in Germany found that measuring by weight the number of flying insects in that country's nature reserves, the number decreased 75% in just over 2.5 decades. So let's get to some of the reasons why. Pesticides and herbicides, major culprit, neonicotinoids, that sort of thing.
Well, they're getting blamed, but I think the decline actually started before a lot of these pesticides were being used, and we're also seeing declines in places where these compounds are not used extensively. We're starting to see declines, for example, around Philadelphia and northward through New England, where there's really not all that much pesticide use. I think pesticides are definitely part of the problem, but there's other things that we have to worry about, just agricultural intensification. In general, we used to have small family farms that really were nature-friendly. There were hedgerows, and there were weeds, and there were places for wildlife and small mammals. We don't do much of that anymore. We like clean cosmetic gardens or these mega farms where we use herbicides and pesticides, like you say, and even cosmetically clean up the hedgerows, and we don't have weeds around the edges of these large mega farms. So that's part of the problem, but it could be just car strikes. It could be light pollution. It could be forest fragmentation and the exotic plants and animals that are sort of sweeping through places of high human habitation. So it's really alarming. We don't know, and we don't have a single factor in all of the studies. I think there might be 125 scientists involved, and amateurs, I should say, in Germany, where they're looking at this problem. There's a lot of smart people thinking about this, and there's no one single factor, actually, that's been identified.
And it also can be challenging to track insects. Let's talk about that for just a moment. It's not like, you know, trying to track, say, something like the endangered mountain gorilla in Africa. You're tracking a flying, moving population of relatively tiny creatures. Tell us about that.
Well, the real hard part with insects is that they have wild fluctuations in their numbers from year to year. They're boom and bust species. That's how they've evolved and maybe why there's so many. But a gorilla, for example, you could do one population census and you would know how many you had in that population, and it'd probably be very close to that the year before or the year after. That's never true of insects. They're going to fluctuate. And so it makes it very hard for scientists to collect data on and actually know whether something's declining and whether we should worry. But the data from Europe, both England and Germany and the Netherlands, is really starting to show sort of a slow decline. I shouldn't say slow. It's 10% of the biomass, or 10% of the number per decade is disappearing, or maybe it's even faster than that. We're getting a real steady decline, and this is going to affect bird life, it's going to affect pollination, it's going to affect recycling, it's going to affect all kinds of ecosystem services that humans depend on.
So, David, if in 10 years this decline doesn't slow, what does the world look like?
Well, we really don't even want to think about that, but you could have dung accumulating in your yards and carrion and leaf litter accumulating in forests. We certainly would have less songbirds. The nature would be drained out of our yards and our, you know, even preserves that we've set up to protect wildlife. We're going to see a decline in the number of birds and reptiles and amphibians and what have you, and insects, no more butterflies, the extinction or extirpation of wildflowers. It's a world we don't want to live in. It's too diminished.
David Wagner is professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Connecticut, and we're beginning the show by talking about some huge declines in insect populations across the world. Is there funding, David, to do the research needed into the decline in insect populations? Is there an awareness of the need to act and perhaps act quickly?
I think it's your show today and the New York Times article, the Washington Post article, that it's really going to be sounding the clarion call that we need to sit up, pay attention, start repeating historical studies. But there isn't a lot of funding in place at present. Europe's a little bit ahead of us, so I think the funding stream is going to open up there. But we have to understand this phenomenon. We have to get better data. And more importantly, we need to identify the causal factors. I wish I could tell you what's driving this, but we really don't know.
Well, there have been some theories that climate change might be a culprit. I know that there was a study that regarded insect populations in the Puerto Rican rainforest, and I think that's getting a second look. But out of that came the theory that, you know, some of these insects are so heat sensitive that even going up a degree or two Celsius can really knock them out.
Yeah, I'm a little suspicious of that. Insects are cold-blooded, so their temperature fluctuations, even on a daily basis, drop from maybe 50 to, I don't know, 80, 90 degrees over the course of the day. What I think insects really struggle with that's related to increasing temperatures is drought. So we saw it in the American West this year. There were times when there was 100 fires burning at a time. And I think with rising global temperatures, we're going to see more frequent droughts, more severe droughts and droughts of longer duration, and that's going to come at great consequence to the plants and animals of this planet that we inherited, and they've been in their own struggle for existence with us for millennia, and I think they will all be imperiled, or many will be imperiled by droughts and the like associated with climate change and these severe weather events.
David,
species aren't... Go ahead.
Oh, no, finish your thought.
I was going to say that we think about climate change and 2 degrees increases in temperatures and that sort of thing, and these are the averages that we hear in the news or even on TV programs, but it's not averages that determine the welfare of a wildflower or a songbird or a butterfly. It's actually the temperature and weather extremes that determine whether or not something's going to survive and be there in the next generation. And that's what we're seeing with climate change and putting more carbon into the atmosphere, is we're going to see more extreme weather, and that's going to drive the extinctions.
So focusing on insects, which are harmful to humans, obviously there was this story about the Zika epidemic,
yeah, sure,
and efforts to eradicate mosquitoes. And a listener, Nancy, is asking, was the effort to eradicate mosquitoes in response to Zika likely to be devastating to hummingbirds and other desirable animals? Is anybody watching this?
Well, everything we do to control insect pests, and there are insect pests that can, remove billions of dollars worth of food and fruit and stored products every year. But every time we use pesticides or one thing to control another, there's going to be collateral damage, non-target effects. And so absolutely, when we eliminate some of these pests or try to eliminate Zika, there's going to be some losses of wildlife. And so nature and control and pesticide application is all sort of a risk, and we have to consider benefits and winners and losers, and I don't have a simple solution for that.
Yeah, no easy answer that situation. All right, so Joel tweets, honestly, this bug extinction is a bit of bad news, and all the world's bad news that terrifies me the most. I don't like the world I'm leaving to my son, and I'm angry at how powerless I am to do much of anything about it. What can we do at home? And David, earlier you kind of referenced the fact that in agriculture, if it's not a small family farm, weeds and borders are just kind of taken out for these clean lines. I mean, what can we do at home to encourage the preservation of insects, if anything?
Well, the most important thing, I think, is to vote in a way that protects Mother Earth and to bring a little bit of that to our yards. I think how we landscape our yards is very, very important. I think we want to move away from all the ornamentals that we buy. When you buy ornamentals, often these are exotics from other countries. They're not going to be able to support caterpillars. And if you have all these plants in your yard that the native caterpillars can't eat, then you're essentially saying birds are not welcome in my yard. And so I think what we plant with, being more nature friendly in terms of our ornamental plantings, and maybe thinking about butterfly gardens, and people are building pollinator gardens now just for bees. I think there's tremendous potential there in how we design buildings and the like. So I think that's positive news. And one other thing that I should mention about insects is they have tremendous capacity for reproduction. The average insect's producing 200 offspring. So if we get things right, I think that they can bounce back a lot faster than a gorilla, or they can bounce back a lot faster than a...
We'll leave the conversation on a positive note. David Wagner, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, sure. Thank you.
David is professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Connecticut. Next up, we look at one insect in particular, and that is the bee. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. That's a bit of Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov's The Flight of the Bumblebee to get this part of the hour started. I'm Mary Cummings. Jordan Marty Moskowain has the day off today. We've been talking about reports of a huge loss of insect populations around the world and the devastating effect this can have on the rest of nature. We're going to focus now on one particular insect over which over the course of history has developed an intimate relationship with the human world, and that is the bee. Bees are as vulnerable as any other insect to what some have dubbed the insect apocalypse. And for the rest of the hour, we'll talk about exactly who the bee is, its role in our lives, and how we can help to protect it. Tor Hansen is a conservation biologist and Guggenheim fellow who's written Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. And he joins us for Radio Times from Portland, Oregon. An early call for you, Tor. We appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me on, Mary.
So first, what's your reaction to the reporting that there are now precipitous declines in insect populations across the global ecosystem?
Well, it's a truly alarming trend for a number of reasons, and I know your last guest, David, had a lot to say on that. And certainly bees are a part of that. And one of the aspects of it that is most alarming to us in that we're so dependent upon bees, not only for the pollination of wonderful wildflowers and things that we enjoy on a nature walk, but also for so much of the food that we eat is either dependent wholly upon or benefits tremendously from the pollination efforts of bees. So it's among the insects out there one of the groups that we will feel most immediately an impact from in these declines.
You write that the extraordinary relationship between humans and bees actually extends over millennia, and according to your writing, despite their ability to sting throughout history and cultures, people have bonded with bees. Guessing honey is probably the obvious reason?
Well, it's an unusual relationship, isn't it? And that if you think about insects and, you know, arthropods in general, these are critters that we generally don't bring close into our world. You know, we have a certain sort of suspicion, I think, of any creature that has an exoskeleton, you know, these goopy bodies sort of hidden away within a chitinous exterior. There's something very foreign to us about that. And you can even measure brain reaction and see a fear response, a measurable reaction in the brain when people are shown, you know, pictures or exposed to insects or spiders and things like that. So it's quite unusual then that we have over time in cultures around the world overlooked that natural aversion, if you will, to bond with bees. And it has to do with the honey that they provide. It has to do with the wax that was also such and continues to be an important product. If you think about honey just alone, that was the sweetest thing in the human diet for millennia before the advent of refined sugars. And then if you look at all of the medicinal value of bee products and all of the, you know, early industrial values, if you will, of the wax, whether it was for erasable writing tablets or metal making or waterproofing, all of these wonderful things, it becomes, you know, then no surprise to learn that we domesticated the honeybee long before horses or ducks or camels and, you know, popular crops like pears and apples, even coffee, very relevant here for an early morning for me, even coffee, our beloved coffee, came to us long after we had domesticated the bees.
Let me reintroduce you. Tor Hansen is a conservation biologist and the author of a number of books. His latest is Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. Lines are open at 888-477-9499. Send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times or an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. And we've been getting a lot of response to this topic. Facebook comment from Carrie. He says, I'm wondering what effect flowerless lawns are having on pollinators. When I was growing up, most lawns had dandelions and clovers and such. Now you can drive for miles through the suburbs without seeing a single blossom. And you referenced this a little bit. I think one of your quotes is about looking at a beautiful golf course, and wow, doesn't that look nice? But it's barren for creatures like bees.
Sure. It really is a desert for these creatures. We look at some of these landscape features that we see as natural and beautiful, but if you remove those floral resources, there's nothing there for bees and a range of other insects as well. One of the threats, really the overarching threats to bees, in our world right now is what they term poor nutrition, really. And that means simply the lack of flowers. And you see it in lawns where, dandelions, which are wonderful bee plants and other things are strictly controlled. You see it in agricultural areas. I think as your previous guest was mentioning, the way we farm now at a large scale, we tend to go from road edge to road edge in the field without hedgerows, and we control weeds strictly. So you don't even have a nice tasty thistle for a bee out there any longer. And so we really do see a lack of floral resources that is one of the stressors acting upon bees in that they are hungry. And when they're not getting enough to eat, they are not nearly as robust in resisting the other stressors and threats that they face.
So, Tor, if we want to encourage beneficial insects like bees to come around again, do we need to embrace weeds, certain weeds, and if so, which ones should we embrace?
Well, it's a great question. I have a friend in my neighborhood who told me, recently, said, I've started mowing my lawn around the dandelions and letting them blossom, and I'm getting all these great insects out there, all these bees and things. So there are things that we can do, and this is really the good news about it as well. And David mentioned in one of his last comments the quick response time that you can see for many insects in that they reproduce quickly. And it's one of the rare situations in conservation biology where if you take action, even in your own backyard, to help these creatures, you can see what really is instant gratification. Over the course of a single season, you can see an increase in the bees and other creatures, other insects, using these flowers. If you get out there and let some of the dandelions bloom, or even better, start planting flowers specifically to benefit these creatures. And it's a wonderful win-win situation in that the types of plants that bees find attractive are also beautiful to us. Mm. And so if you plant a yard where you have blooming flowers from the spring through the summer, which is exactly what you want to see in your yard, that's going to not only please you, but benefit a huge range of bees.
Which leads to this Facebook comment from Frank, who says, in my backyard garden, only some plant varieties bore vegetables. Seems bees specialize in what they pollinate. Some bee species were absent this summer, and that's according to Frank's observations. So, any specific, a little bit more specific in terms of what we might want to see in the back to encourage bees to help help the tomatoes along, whatever else might be back there.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a range of things. You have some bees that are generalists and will visit all sorts of flowers. And there are many, common things like catmint, for example, which you can pick up at any garden store and is very robust, and you can grow it with minimal care. And it's a great plant for a range of bees, of generalist bees. You have things like lavender that do well in a dry garden. You don't even have to water this stuff, and it's wonderful for the bees when it blooms. And then you can expand from some of these to start looking for some regionally native plants as well that are becoming more available now, some perennials and some annuals and things that you can plant that will really increase the abundance and diversity of bees in your yard in that you start to pick up some of these specialists. And I think the listener comment there, gets at this idea that some bees indeed are particular about what they will visit. And so if you have some regionally native plants in your yard too, you're going to start picking up more of these mining bees and diggers and leaf cutters and fabulous local bees that are out there waiting and looking for flowers. And you can find them you're right there in your yard once you start giving them what they need.
So, and we are not just talking about honeybees, of course, which I didn't realize are actually an invasive species in North America. Is that to the detriment of native bees here?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm going to get to it in a minute. I just want to mention one thing, just following up on that last comment, and that is to look up. There's a group on the internet called the Xerces Society, X-E-R-C-E-S, and they have lists of great bee plants that are regionally specific. So you can look up your region and find some great ideas about things to plant, both native things and then things you can get at the garden store. And to move on then to your next question, which is a fabulous one. And, you know, when we think of bees, our minds, I believe, immediately turn to the bee we know best, which is the honeybee. And as you point out, it's not a native species to North America. I was listening, you know, not too long ago to a radio program where an historian of science pointed out that the colonists arriving at Plymouth and Jamestown brought honeybees with them from Europe, which is true. But then he went on to say that if he hadn't, there would have been nothing here to pollinate their crops. And I nearly drove off the road. I was driving my car. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, we have 4,000 species of native bees happily buzzing around this continent. And you do have now a situation where our wonderful honeybees, we are reliant upon them in many ways, and they're great, great creatures. But there is now, you know, some serious competition in certain situations between honeybees and some of these native pollinators. So it's not something people worry about so much in the backyard setting or in small-scale beekeeping. But sometimes you can see competition up in, say, mountain meadows if you bring hives up to pasture, so to speak. In these places, large numbers of honeybees can outcompete natives in those situations. So there is some awareness now about competition and also the potential for honeybee diseases to be transmitted to native bees. So this is one of the things that people are working on in terms of bee health and trying to figure out how to lessen competition, where it's important, where it isn't, so that we can have our honeybees and the wonderful pollination and products they supply without threatening native bees.
Let's get an update on colony collapse disorder, which I believe the focus was on how this affected honeybees in the United States, but did it also affect wild bees? And if you could, just before we even get into that, just to remind our listeners of what colony collapse disorder is.
Sure. So colony collapse disorder really sprang upon the scene in 2006 when commercial beekeepers, who really are the people who know how to care for honeybees the best, they do it for a living, and they started losing huge numbers of hives, you know, 30%, 40%. Some beekeepers were losing 80 to 90% of their hives. These hives were just emptying of bees for mysterious reasons. And if there is a silver lining to that crisis, it lies in the incredible surge of research into bees that it inspired. Everyone trying to understand what was going on. And a decade later or more now, only one thing has become clear, and that is that it's more than one thing.
You know what, Tor, I'm going to jump in for 1 second. I'm going to do a station ID, and then we can continue. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Okay, pick up your thought.
Yes, so at any rate, it's not one smoking gun that is responsible for colony collapse or for bee declines, but rather a combination of stressors. We mentioned poor nutrition. Experts also summarized several of the key stressors with other P words. They call it the four P's: poor nutrition, but also parasites like the deadly varroa mites that infest honeybees and related mites will infest other bees. You have parasites, so you have pathogens, various bee diseases, and also, of course, pesticides, which hamper the development of bees in a number of ways.
I'm sorry. You also add to that climate change?
Yeah, so if you have the four P's and then you add in things like invasive species and things like climate change, you know, climate change being this term I think is fabulous, but it's what the military calls climate change. They call it a stress multiplier or a threat multiplier, right? So any threat that you have going on, and it's true for bees as it is for issues of national security, becomes multiplied when you add climate change to the picture, because it's another stress on the whole ecosystem that is torquing this whole thing and making things worse. And so it's an incredibly complicated situation then for bees. Hard to tease apart the cause of any particular bee decline. Colony collapse itself, the sort of classic empty hive symptoms that we saw from 2006 onward for several years, is actually has been in decline in recent years.
Well, that's encouraging.
It is, but what's less encouraging is that you see colony collapse accounting for only 5% of the loss of hives, but beekeepers are still losing 30 to 40% of their stock. So that alerts us to the fact that it is this multiple stress situation that is affecting bees, and these stressors can interact in all sorts of complex ways. So it's a troubling and difficult thing to untangle, but the good news is that we do know enough now to take action in specific ways by reducing pesticide use, by limiting the amount of travel for bees, you know, by moving bees from place to place. We tend to move their pathogens with them, so that is another stressor on bees. And by, you know, providing more flowers and nesting habitat in, you know, not only our backyards but out in agricultural areas, we can see then the bees really rebounding when we take these simple steps. And as your earlier guest pointed out, insects in general have the ability to recover quickly if we can give them a little breathing room.
Tor Hansen, are you seeing big agriculture adopting any of these changes?
Oh, great question. And there are some really encouraging examples out there. Of course, we have swung, the pendulum has swung way far in the direction of landscape scale, single crop, you know, industrial monocultures where you don't have much habitat for the bees. Even if it's a bee-pollinated crop, it may flower for only a few weeks, and then the rest of the year it's a desert in that landscape. But people are beginning now to, in some cases, reintroduce some bee habitat into these landscapes. One of the places where this is happening at a larger scale is in the almond groves of Central California, where you have, you know, almonds, which must be bee-pollinated. Every almond you eat has been touched by a bee in its past. They have to be bee-pollinated. And yet such vast orchards now with very little bee habitat, aside from those briefly flowering almond trees, that there aren't enough native local bees in the landscape to do the job. And so bees must be imported, honeybees, from around the country, you know, millions, 2 million hives at least, to take care of all of that pollination. So you have thousands of acres now in those landscapes where people are starting to replant hedgerows and things to encourage native bees to help relieve the burden on those rented hives.
All right. More on bees in just a moment here on Radio Times. Tor Hansen is author of Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. Keep it here. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. And along with us for the rest of the hour, conservation biologist Tor Hansen is author of Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. We're talking about the evolution of bees, why they've been particularly hard hit in recent years, and the critical role they play in the natural and human worlds. The number to call if you'd like to join us, 888-477-9499. Of course, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Time. So Tor, bees have inspired, of course, art, poetry, prose, some of which you include in your book, like this lighthearted bit from Norman, I think it's Roland Gale, "You voluble, velvety, vehement fellows that play on your flying and musical cellos. Come out of my foxglove, come out of my roses, you bees with the plushy and plausible noses." I just think that's terrific.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah. And also there was a passage before we wrap up the show, I just wanted you to read this, if you could, called "A Day in the Sun" by conservationist John Muir.
Oh, I'd be happy to. And I think what it embodies and what that passage from Gale does as well is this deep connection that we have to bees. And one of the parts of helping to bring them back in conservation is really an act of remembrance. You know, it's reconnecting with our deep history with bees. And if you think about how well these authors must have known bees to write these passages, that I think is very inspiring. And so this comes to us from John Muir. In this flowery wilderness, the bees rove and revel, rejoicing in the bounty of the sun, clambering eagerly through bramble and hucklebloom, ringing the myriad bells of the manzanita, now humming aloft among polleny willows and firs, now down on the ashy ground among the gilias and buttercups, and anon plunging deep into the snowy banks of cherry and buckthorn. They consider the lilies and roll into them, and, like lilies, they toil not, for they are impelled by sun power, as water wheels by water power. And when the one has plenty of high-pressure water, the other plenty of sunshine, they hum and quiver alike.
You know, the thought that immediately occurs is that he took the time to make these observations and to enjoy what he was watching. And Tor, I'm wondering if some of the stress we seem to experience in today's 24/7 world can be relieved by a little bee watching.
Oh, I heartily agree. And it really is something that anyone can experience, in that, you know, we tend to be in this modern indoor and technology and media-focused culture separating ourselves from nature quite a lot. Yet bees are these natural wonders that we can find in the backyard, in the park, on the side of the road verge, you know, where there are some blooming flowers. You will find these creatures, and to spend some time with them is revealing, is soothing, and will help us as well as help them.
Maybe pull up a chair and have a nice cool drink next to, you know, sitting next to you. Obviously, they're out in the summer, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure people ask you this all the time, though. I mean, when you are observing bees, how do you avoid getting stung?
Yeah. So, yes, bee stings are, you know, can be a serious concern, particularly to people who have an allergy. But the good news is that the majority of bees don't sting at all. In fact, male bees lack a stinger altogether. The stinger itself evolved from what the entomologists call the ovipositor, which is the egg-laying device. So male bees simply don't have the equipment. And many of the native solitary bees have either lost the inclination or ability, even in some cases, to sting. So a lot of bees are perfectly harmless. And even the ones that do sting or have the ability to, like bumblebees or honeybees, rarely do so. So you have the ability then to watch bees without getting stung or without having much fear, particularly by simply giving them a bit of space and avoiding a situation where they might get trapped, you know, in your clothing or, you know, in your armpit or wherever else, because they will sting if they are threatened in that situation.
So when you say a bit of space, you're talking about a foot if somebody really wants to get close to see what a bee's doing?
Yeah, so choose your bees wisely, but I would say particularly for some of the gentler, even things like bumblebees, which are big and fuzzy and easy to see and quite fascinating in their behavior, it's possible to get quite close to them when they are busy on a flower, and they will completely ignore you. And if you feel truly bold, you can reach out and capture one gently in your hands, the way my young son has done since the age of three, barehanded.
Really?
And hold them briefly before letting them go. And again, help reestablish not only our connection but our fascination with bees, because they need our curiosity now as well as our help.
We've got calls and comments coming into 888-477-9499. John in Collingswood joins us now. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks.
I have a comment about keeping bees. I've kept bees for like 12 to 15 years in my backyard. In the last two or three years, there have been private mosquito services, and they've wiped out my bees. And I'm wondering, you know, I've done some research on whether these are, you know, the stuff they're spraying is poisonous to the bees or not, and I haven't been able to come up with anything, so I'm kind of interested whether your expert knows anything about those compounds and whether they're really whacking my bees, because it seems like
All right. Thanks, John, for the call to Radio Times. Tor, what do you think?
Well, it's a great question, and it's certainly a possibility. Any, you know, general insecticide will affect bees just as well as, you know, other target insects. There are insecticides that are more specific in what they target, and some of those are less harmful to bees. But it's possible, certainly, and you do see situations where spraying for pests drifts into beekeeping areas and can wipe out hives completely if the concentrations are high enough. So if you do have that sort of spraying going on in your area, it's possible. And again, I don't know specifically because, of course, I don't know all the pesticides out there or what might be sprayed in your neighborhood, but it's certainly something that is a concern and that has affected bees in other areas.
Tor Hansen, interestingly, some insects can actually develop an immunity to certain pesticides, but bees cannot.
Well, they're less likely to, and this is sort of a fascinating biological situation. It's, you know, it's an evolutionary situation that we rarely stop to think about. But why is it that all these pest insects develop, you know, resistance where the bees seem to get whacked, you know, by such a wide range of pesticides? And it has to do with their ecology. If you think about the target species, many of the pests are things that eat plant material. They devour the leaves or the buds or the fruits or the seeds. And these are the things that, farmers or the rest of us are trying to eliminate in our yards. But those insects, of course, have evolved in this constant state of back and forth with the plants they're eating, where the plants are developing chemicals to drive them away. And they're overcoming those chemicals, detoxifying them in some way. They have all these metabolic pathways to do so. So if a new pesticide is applied, it, in often cases, an herbicide or something or a pesticide, it's often only a matter of time before those insects will overcome what to them is just one more chemical that they have to detoxify. Whereas bees do not have that history in that they eat nectar and they eat pollen, which are things that plants use to attract the bees to them. So they're not generally full of these harmful chemicals. So bees do not have the evolutionary history of overcoming chemical defenses of plants. And that is one of the reasons they continue to be so susceptible to such a wide range of pesticides.
Not sure if you have this information at your fingertips, but a question from Paul who asks, how big a role did Monsanto play in bee and insect decline?
Oh, well, I don't have the information specifically, but of course, being, you know, a large scale a chemical producer, you know, of a variety of different products, and also now very deeply involved in seed production as well, you know, it's a big agrochemical company at this point. You know, they play a role in this general pattern that we've seen, particularly over the last 50 years or so, in terms of moving away from smaller scale farming towards an industrial scale farming, which involves a lot of chemicals and whatnot, and also changes these rural landscapes. It's one of the surprises when you look at the bee research going on out there to find these studies that will actually find lower abundance and diversity of bees and poorer bee health in rural areas in many cases than in suburbs or even urban places where the habitat is more diverse for them. But you get out into some of these monocultures and there's very little there. So Monsanto is part of that in terms of this move towards a different style of agriculture that provides less food, that provides less habitat, nesting habitat for a variety of bees, and that is more chemical dependent, in many cases at least, not always, but often, in ways that make it harder for bees to thrive in those rural areas.
Facebook comment from Anastasia. Is there something we can do politically on the local level to encourage our cities, towns, and townships to protect bees? She says, I've heard of cities being certified bee-friendly. What are the possibilities associated with that?
Oh, that's another great question. And this, again, is one of these positive stories where you can get a town involved or any local entity. And it boils down to the way they manage land, right? You can get out and spray the sides of all the roads and keep them keep the weeds down that way, or you can shift towards more of a mowing schedule that relies less on chemicals, and you start to see then bees and other insects thriving in road verges. You can encourage townships to use less pesticides in the way they manage parks, and you begin then to see more insects in these places. They become refuges. You can encourage the planting of various native or good flowering resources for bees and other insects in public spaces. There are all sorts of things that towns can do, and people have the ability to steer that activity from their local political platform.
Important to note that in addition, you perhaps might want to try beekeeping as a hobby, to check with the township, because I read locally Hatfield Borough in Montgomery County here recently passed an ordinance regulating beekeeping after complaints about a resident who ended up with 14 hives on his property. So important to get all the rules down.
Yes, absolutely. And also, if you do decide to keep honeybees, which is a marvelous way to know bees well and to learn about them, remember too that one of the threats to bees, all the bees in your neighborhood, the locals as well as the honeybees, is a lack of flowers. So if you want to get a hive, don't just get a hive. Remember that you need to provide them with some food as well. Otherwise, you're introducing, 10, 20,000 bees into a landscape where there's not enough food. So remember to get out and plant things in your yard as well as bringing in those hives.
And I'll just with this in mind, add a couple comments. Comment from Rita, who says, I have a huge bank of lavender that blooms beautifully in the summer. It's always covered in bees. One of my favorite things to do is sit on the grass and watch them do their thing. It's relaxing, kind of like a fish tank. And she says, I've never been stung. Then we also have a tweet from Sarah, who says, in my yard, native bees love purple marjoram, which is, an edible relative of oregano. You are listening to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is WHYY in Philadelphia. So, Tor, in the remaining couple moments here, let's get to an email from Bernie who says, I keep honeybees in East Kensington, which is a section of Philadelphia, in my backyard. In recent years, I suffered two colony collapses. Then an unscrupulous developer next door knocked over my hive and the bees left. I found that watching honeybees can be very interesting and relaxing, but the environmental issues we have today are anything but relaxing to my poor honeybees. So, with somebody in Bernie's situation, how would you advise him?
Well, honeybee keeping, is a challenge. And that's something that you learn, I think, when you take on that role of caring for bees, that it's not easy anyway, but particularly in this, modern world where there are so many stresses that they face. So, I don't have specific advice other than, of course, you could try again with honeybees, or you could take some of the steps like, we just had these comments from these folks who had lavender or the marjoram in their yard. You can also start to enjoy bees in another way by planting a big bed of lavender or whatever it may be, a combination of flowers, and then spend some time watching the bees that arrive there. And also providing nesting habitat in your yard as well, not just the flowers, but patches of bare ground for the diggers or holes in wood or paper tubes for some of the mason bees and leaf cutters and others. And you'll start to see this huge variety of bees and have this interaction with bees that can be very peaceful and also benefits them, but in a way that is maybe perhaps less stressful than trying to keep a hive going under challenging circumstances.
So some fun bee facts to close the show out. The differences between bees and wasps. For one, bees are vegetarian.
Yes, absolutely. So bees evolved from the wasps. Wasps had been around for millions of years before the bees came along. They still look quite a lot like them. But the key innovation that set them on their own evolutionary pathway was dietary. Instead of being carnivores out hunting, caterpillars or other insects or spiders to feed to their young, bees learned to provision themselves and their offspring solely from the products provided by flowers.
And bees can see, and they see color, including that which is in ultraviolet light?
Yeah, their visual spectrum is a little different from ours, and there are all sorts of bee colors. They call it bee purple, even though we don't quite know what it looks like, but down in that ultraviolet zone that appear on flower petals that direct the bees, attract the bees in ways that we can only imagine.
Well, we could have gone on for another hour at least. Tor Hansen, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Have a good morning out there.
You too. Tor is author of Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. And don't forget to check out our podcasts and social media. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today is Adam Staniszewski. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, great to have you along for Radio Times.